All right, Jason, I think I have the most important question about all of anime that I've ever asked you right now.
I'm excited.
Why is the Akira slide so cool?
Because it's on a motorcycle. Can you imagine if you tried to do that on a horse? You'd break its legs.
Well, I don't want to hurt any horses.
Look, I am not endorsing horse pain. I feel bad that I've started out the podcast with this, but I am endorsing motorcycle pain.
Motorcycle pain.
Because I think it just looks cool. I think because you think if a real rider would do that, they would flop over. But the fact that it's Kaneda, right?
It is Kaneda, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He slides and puts his foot down and... I don't know. I think it's just like, I don't think anything had been done in animation quite like that up until that point.
Okay, important follow-up question. Yeah. What is cooler, the Akira slide or the web-slinger horse falling from the ceiling in Across the Spider-Verse?
Well, I mean, what? That's what you want to compare it to?
You evoked horses, and that was the first thing I thought of.
Well, it's of course the Akira slide. I can't compare it to a movie that just came out like about a couple months ago.
There you go. Okay, so we're going to talk even more Akira slide because hello and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Ashley Victoria Robinson.
And I am Jason Cybernetic Metal Hand Inman. Welcome to Geek History Lesson. This is the podcast where we teach you about one movie, one character, one book, one anime movie in a little bit less than an hour, and we call ourselves the Mind University because you're here to be geeky, you're here to learn, and we are here to talk about Akira.
That's about as far as our Japanese pronunciation is going to go, so I'm going to say right off the bat, please be forgiving.
We are also going to apologize for all kinds of names that are quite difficult for our very white and very North American tongues, but I'm excited to talk about this 1988 movie. Is this an anniversary, right? That's
it's
what we're talking about.
35 years old.
35. Wow.
When this I don't know why I was German for
it's got about 5 years left for to being cool.
Yeah.
Once it hits 40, everybody's gonna be like, buy a minivan, old man. That's what they're gonna say about
Akira. And Kaneda's gonna do the slide in the minivan.
Oh, he will do it in like a Ford Windstar. Yes, he will.
Great, I can. Wow, that's a reference just for Ashley. But Jason and I couldn't do this alone. So we reached back into the Geek History Lesson archives and we said, we want our most legendary tenured professor at the Mind University to come and join us. So please, everybody, put your hands together and welcome, along with us, the executive producer and major spoilers of majorspoilers.com and the Major Spoilers Podcast Network contributor to Digital Producer, Creative Mac, Digital Webcast, Digital Animators, and the DV Format websites, part of the Digital Media Online Network of Communities, actual university professor and granddaddy of Geek History Lesson, our most returned special guest professor, Steven Schleicher. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for that intro. I feel like I should go out and buy a minivan and try to do an Akira slide.
I felt like you were sliding the entire... Yeah, I felt that too. I was like, Steven could do this slide throughout that entire intro, and that would be quite impressive.
We usually just give the credit of being the big boss from Major Spoilers, but I was like, Steven has a lot of real accomplishments.
By the way,
I'm older than this movie, so when you're saying somebody that's been around since before Akira, yes, that's me. Hello.
Is Steven our most returned guest?
Steven is definitely hands down our returned guest.
Oh, wow. Really?
Wow. Nice.
We have Steven on like annually at least. So yeah, Steven is 100% our most returned professor. So
nice. Well, Ashley, should we explain why we pulled in Steven? I mean,
okay, we can, but I think it's better save it for the meet cute.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
I think that fits more thematically with the flow of the podcast.
All right, so are we ready to kick off into the 10-cent origin?
Yes, let's.
All right, everybody, we're going to know the first section of our podcast. That is where Ashley is going to give you the Cliff Notes version of everything you need to know about Akira in case you go to not a cocktail party, but let's say an aromatic experience party in Neo Tokyo, and someone says, who is this Akira?
Mm-hmm. So, Akira is a 1998 Japanese adult animated cyberpunk action film, which is straightforward and makes a ton of sense, that was released on July 16th, 1988, of course, in Japan originally. and was directed by Katsuhiro Otomo. It was also written by Katsuhiro Otomo and Izo Hashimoto. It is based on the manga of the same name by Katsuhiro Otomo. So the guy who originally created it, directed, and co-wrote the movie. It is produced by Tokyo Movie Shinsha and the Akira Committee. It was distributed by Toho, which is the same company that distributes the Godzilla films, also a bunch of other anime that we all really like, with a runtime of 124 minutes. The original budget was 7 million yen. That's about $9.9 million US, and that does include the advertising budget. And it was at the time considered to be the most expensive anime project ever made, although that... some people will tell you that's apocryphal, but that's sort of the lore that followed Akira when it was first made. So original budget, 9.9 million US dollars, once you count advertising afterward. The box office gross was 49 million US dollars.
So this is a massive hit.
So to say that it was a runaway success is an understatement.
All right, cool.
And that's your Tencent origin.
And now it's time to move into the meet cute, where we're first all going to reveal how we first meted or cuted Akira. It was the term we stole from romantic comedies. And I think it's perfect to start with our guest, Mr. Steven Schleicher. Steven, where were you the first time you saw Akira?
I was in a dorm room in 1990. It was either 1990 or 1991. So check it out. The movie was released in Japan in 1988. I went to college beginning in 1989, and I immediately made friends with a lot of international students, including a bunch of Japanese students who were really cool. Used to hang out with them a lot. We used to eat our lunches and our dinners together and just have a really good time. At one point, one of the Japanese students went back to Japan, and he came back after the break, and everybody, I came down to the lunch table one day, and everybody's like, duh, 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 you know, they're all whispering and chattering and very excited. I was like, what's going on? And they're like, Ken came back with a copy of Akira. And I'm like, that's great. What is it? And it's like, oh, they're like, it is this big anime movie. We're going to go up into the room tonight and watch it together. And like, okay. So imagine a room is a men's dorm. So imagine a room of like 10 people. There's me and one other white guy there. And we're all watching this on a little tiny 13-inch VHS TV VCR combo. And they put it in and they're like, this is like the biggest movie in Japan. I'm like, okay, great. I'm ready for it. And there's a box of wine there. So, you know, we're about to have a big party.
Oh, boy.
And of course, you know, it all opens up. And I'm just like, what is this film? This is like, you know, that opening sequence when they're doing the bike race through Tokyo and taking on the Jokers and everything. It's just like, what are the clowns, I should say. And I, like every 5 minutes, I'm like, what'd they say?
Right.
And
I want to point out this part of the story where I was going to be like, Steven, subs or dubs?
Oh, no. This was the original. He brought it with him. He got a copy of it in the original Japanese. Mm-hmm. And because the Japanese and U.S. VHS format is compatible, you can just pop it in and watch it. So I was watching the original Japanese version of this, no subtitles, no dubs. And every 5 minutes, I'm like, what's going on?
And wow.
At one point, the guy is just like, just watch this. It'll all become clear at the end. And I was like, by the end of it, I was like, I don't know what I watched, but I need a copy of this. And so I took it to a guy who did a bunch of our VHS dubs at the university. I was like, please, can I pay you to make a copy of this? He's like, yeah, sure. It'll take a day. I come back the next day. He goes, I don't know. Something's wrong with that VHS. I think the audio's all messed up on it.
Oh,
because it was all in the original Japanese.
Yeah.
And I bet I burned through that VHS over the next year or so. I probably watched it at least once a month for a year, if not more than that. So that'd be 1990.
When was the first time you saw it with subtitles or dubs? Like, when did you finally learn what they said?
By the time that it came into the United States, I would have to look and see what year it came into the United States. But I bet it was like closer to 2000, like maybe. Oh,
wow.
I bet it was like 95, 96 by the time I was able to see a first dub of it. And it wouldn't have been a dub. It would have been a sub.
Wow. OK.
And I was like, OK, finally, I've been watching this thing like forever. Let me see what the story's actually about. And even after I watch it, I'm like, I'm not sure I know what this movie's about.
So I can't find when it was officially released in the United States because it got a theatrical release from March to December of 2001.
All right.
with both the original English dub and subs, but obviously there would have been copies that came through before, but just on the quickest Google search, that was what I found.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I definitely remember importing a copy of it when I knew that I could get a dubbed version of it, because I was just like, or a subbed version of it, because I was like, I gotta know what this movie's about. But of course, by that time, I was so impressed by the movie. Mm-hmm. Epic, which was an imprint of Marvel at the time, was doing the manga reprints
here
in the United States with English. And so I started reading those, trying to figure out and piece together what was going on. But at that time, comic book market, et cetera, it was hard for me to find all of the individual issues in their order, because by the time I got around to grabbing them, it had been published for about a year. So it was very scattered for me to try and read that in the U.S. in the English version.
I know. Now you can just buy the nice big box set, which we're going to recommend to everybody at the end of this podcast.
if there's a Geek History Lesson Amazon affiliate link, $127, I think, is what the box set is. And that is a really good price for over 2,000 pages of comics. So
I love that you also know that it's over 2,000 pages. That was one of my fun facts. Because that was like one of the highest numbers, at least for stuff that was being imported into the U.S. at that time.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, there's things that are much longer than that. But
now, yeah,
for as long as the manga ran from what, like 82? To 90 something.
91, I believe.
Yeah, man, that's a lot of comics. That's a lot of pages. And granted, it reads kind of quick because there's a lot of action sequences in it, but still 2000 pages to try to sit down and read. Take your time on it, boys and girls.
Especially in that Ford Windstar on a road trip. Yeah. Ashley, where did you first watch Akira?
I vividly remember watching this movie for the first time.
Was it in a Ford Windstar?
No. Okay. My family would have been driving a Buick something.
A Buick Skylark.
No, it was in a car. It doesn't matter. It was blue. Anyway, 2006. Canada, a wood paneled basement. My very first ever boyfriend, his bedroom is down there. He allegedly knew how to torrent things better than I allegedly knew how to torrent things in 2006.
Is that true?
Allegedly, it's true.
Okay.
And he allegedly had a torrent.
Listeners, I will just tell you, as somebody who knows Ashley Victoria Robinson personally, I'm going to bet that statement is true.
No, I don't want to be prosecuted. It's a federal crime.
Oh, no. I'm betting that the boyfriend was better at torrenting than you. And I bet you did not torrent this. I bet you he did.
That's right.
And he lives at 1578 Skylark Lane because Ashley is adverse to technology.
Yeah. So. He also allegedly had a torrent of Ghosts in the Shell.
He had a lot of alleged things. Did he know where Jimmy Hoffa was buried too?
He was maybe. Who can say? He was really into anime. And so he's actually responsible for showing me like a lot of these sort of classic things.
Oh, nice.
And that was where I first watched it. And then I've watched it several times subsequently over the years, including 2 days ago, which was a real thrill for me. So
nice.
Jason, I think you might be our most recent viewer of Akira.
No, I mean, I would have seen it somewhere around 2006.
Okay, so you and I would have been at the same time.
Or 2007. I also,
well, there's a universe where maybe we were watching Akira at the same time.
Maybe.
In 2006.
Also, but not with my alleged boyfriend.
You know, your boyfriend with alleged torrenting capabilities.
He was torrent lazy. No, he's not great at torrenting. No, I saw it. I think I saw it the first time on a DVD copy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend kind of similar. I was in college and I had a friend kind of like Steven who was like, have you seen Akira? This is really cool. And
that's a good friend.
And I had always known of Akira. I had heard of it. Like I'd kind of always been like, oh, I've heard of it. This is like that one, Ghost in the Shell. And then like, what's the one that's like, is it Ninja Scroll?
Yeah.
Ninja Boy.
Yeah,
Ninja
Scroll is a big one.
Evangelion. Yeah, Ninja Scroll is pretty violent, over the top.
Yeah, like, so those four are the ones I would always hear from people where they'd be like, oh, these are the animes that you have to see. And I remember watching it. Yeah, I remember seeing the motorcycle slide as well and kind of being like, oh, I know that.
Yeah.
Or I've seen that before.
Yeah.
I'm aware of this.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'd seen it parodied enough. And I also remember catching on to, like, you know, everybody wearing red or red capes, like that kind of being like a motif, and and also just realizing how many comic book creators in the 90s ripped that off. I actually, like, it's so funny, like, because I had the conversation, and Steven will appreciate this very, when our rewatch of this movie, where I said, oh, do you think that, like, you know, the big climax of this movie where somebody, as I made an allusion to, gets a robot arm, do we think that's where like Rob Liefeld got the idea for Cable to have a robot arm? Because Cable comes out like 2 years after this.
And Jason loves Cable.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean,
that could be a very close possibility for people that have seen this. I mean, you're probably not too far off, although mental states may be a little bit different. In
Of course. They're nowhere close. But when I was rewatching this, I was like, oh, that's very Cable. I wonder if that's where he got the idea. But anyways, I was not in a dorm room. I was in my friend was renting a house in Tulsa, Oklahoma. No wood paneling, Ashley. I'm sorry. But that's where I watched.
Sorry to me, it wasn't my bedroom.
That's where I watched Akira for the very first time. So that's my meet cute.
And I just want to encourage everyone. I'm already having a really good time talking about this episode. And if you are having a great time and you want more of Steven's insight and genius, don't forget that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/Jawin, J-A-W-I-N. We're doing Geekish or Listen Extra this week, and we've already preemptively bullied Steven into sticking around and talking even more Akira and pop culture talk with us. So come check that out. Check out everything else that's going on. It's going to be a super fun, happy time. Okay, Jason. Is it the time? Shall we do the thing?
Do the thing, Julie, do the thing?
Yes, let's do the thing.
The History 101.
Yes.
Okay, let's get to talking about Akira.
Okay.
And Ashley, are you going to take us down some production stuff, I guess?
We're going to start with some pretty heavy production stuff. Nice. And then we'll get into the actual film itself.
I actually have a production thing that I would like to bring up, but I would love...
No, this is my... You yelled at me in Indiana Jones.
That's right.
This,
that's right. Whenever,
no, please go ahead.
Whenever you get a start... No, I want you to set this tail. And then whenever I have a connection, a surprising connection to previous other GHL episodes.
Oh, that's wild. So do I.
From this episode. Maybe we have the same thing. All right, interesting.
Okay, so Otomo, the creator of Akira, had no intention of adapting Akira for the screen, but he became, and I quote from various interviews, very intrigued when he was offered a development deal. So whatever the magical number for how much it was going to cost was offered to him to make this into a movie. It's not greed. Sell your ideas, get paid for your art. He agreed to the adaptation on the grounds that he retained creative control over the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the production company is called the Akira Committee is because it took a group of several production companies who came together with their various skills and to develop the technology to bring Akira to the big screen. And the Akira Committee is made up of Kondasha, Mainichi Broadcasting System, Bandai, Hakuhodo, Toho, Laserdisc Corporation, and Sumitomo Corporation. If you're a manga, anime, or collectibles fan, you probably recognize a few of these names from some stuff that you've purchased over the years.
May I ask a question to our guest?
Sure. Sure. I'm not the guest.
Steven. Well, I wanted to host Professor Ashley. I wanted to make sure. Steven. Did you ever own any Laserdiscs anime?
No, that was out of my reach. That was way expensive for me. And interestingly, by the time that I was starting to phase out of VHS, because I had a huge VHS collection, that's when DVD was starting to take hold. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of skipped over. Yeah, well, eventually it became way cheaper. But yeah, I kind of skipped over that whole DVD collection.
Okay, because that was a big thing in the 90s. And yeah, it was super price. I've never owned a Laserdisc, but I knew people that
we had a VCR, so we were like firmly a VHS fam.
I remember going to like a Books a Million type store where they would sell movies and stuff, and they did have DVD, or I'm sorry, Laserdisc collections that you could buy. And I always look at him and go, you got to flip the disc over to watch the second half of the movie.
They were also just huge. They were just huge.
Yeah.
Anyways. All right. So there you go, Ashley.
Okay. So also Akira, in an unusual move, had pre-scored dialogue. That means they recorded all of the sound and then had to animate to it. This was the first time that this had ever been done. High Tech Lab Japan Incorporated provided computer-generated imagery for the film, including falling objects, model parallax effects on backgrounds, and tweak lighting and lens flares for the first time ever in anime. The film released in 1988, 2 years before the manga wrapped up in 1990, and Otomo stated that he struggled to finish the manga, and his inspiration for the violent ending of the film came from a conversation he had with acclaimed filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Whoa.
Almost made Dune, like one of our weirder, more artsy European filmmakers.
So he was probably like, make it bloody, my friend. Make it bloody.
What if the mutant grows really big? It will be great.
What if he squishes the girl? What if he squishes the girl?
Yeah, really.
Like a pizza.
And when he started making Akira, he had to also, the movie, he was in the thralls of writing a satisfying ending to the 2000 plus pages of stories. Then he had to condense all of that into a 2-hour movie and reflected upon this work order as, quote, the worst possible idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Professor.
No, please. All good.
Have you guys ever watched or are familiar with the Full Metal Alchemist issue?
No, I'm not. What was
so
the issue there?
Like Full Metal Alchemist started as a manga, and it's really cool. It's a great manga series about two boys and alchemy and all these kinds of things. Then they decided to develop a television series on it, an anime series, and the anime series was well received. But because the manga couldn't keep up with the anime went in one direction. The manga went in a different direction, a la Game of Thrones type thing. So much so that by the time they wrapped up the Full Metal Alchemist manga, they had to go back and remake Full Metal Alchemist, the anime, because people were like, we want it to be more like the manga. And I have a feeling it's a good thing that Otomo retained control over everything about this project, because I have a feeling that had he not been in charge of the ending of the anime, the manga would have diverged and been something completely different from that.
Steven, it's so funny that you evoked Game of Thrones, because I had a little note here as a joke to be like, and I hope the same for George R.R. Martin, because I want to speak into the universe that he's going to finish A Song of Ice and Fire, the book series. And in subsequent years and decades, Otomo has stated that he likes that he has two similar but different endings, and that they are different entities, that they're not just carbon copies of each other.
Right. It's very similar to like Scott Pilgrim versus the World as well, like because they finished that movie before the last volume came out.
Except one of the versions is good and one is not.
That's debatable.
That's for the Scott Pilgrim episode that we keep pushing off. Okay, now we can talk plot. Those are most of my facts.
Can I bring up my prediction
thing?
You
can.
Okay, so I was looking up on this, and I only discovered this because of the Wikipedia page, but this Akira film has a connection, actually, to Studio Ghibli.
We have the same fact.
We do?
Yes, we have the same fact.
Do you want me to save it?
No, you can share it. That's fine.
Okay, so I noticed that one of the key animators in this film is this lovely lady named Makiko Futaki, who was a lead animator, and she went on to become a lead animator at Studio Ghibli, including specifically animating the scenes as Mei and Totoro meeting in My Neighbor Totoro. The rooftop meeting between Pazu and Shita in Castle in the Sky, and the opening scene of Kiki's Delivery Service, as well as many scenes from my favorite Studio Ghibli film, Howl's Moving Castle.
That was my fact, as she was the lead animator on both of our favorite Ghibli movies.
Yeah, so like, shout out to Makiko Futaki for like getting her start on Akira and then going on to be more badass.
Yeah, I feel like if you could survive the gauntlet that it seemed to be making this film, you went on to great success in your professional career.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Okay, plot time. At the opening of the movie, a world war is triggered by the destruction of Tokyo on July 16th, 1988, the very date Akira was first released in Japan. Which, honestly, like, the ovaries that it takes to commit to that and get the movie out and done in time is very strong if you know anything about production.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to spoil one of your fun facts, but there's a more recent tie-in to this, but we can save it till a little bit later.
No, go for it.
Drop it now.
So you'll notice that after the war, it's been 31 years, they are rebuilding Tokyo, Neo Tokyo, and it's the year 2019, the year that the Olympics are happening in Tokyo.
Yep.
There is a huge sign in real life, the Tokyo Olympics happening in 2020, I guess it was. There's a huge sign where it says 147 days until the summer or to the Olympics in Japan. Well, in 2020, exactly 147 days before the 2020 Olympics were to occur, they were canceled because of coronavirus.
Oh.
Yeah, so Akira predicted our downfall. Otomo-san knew what he was doing.
Akira was truly a god.
Yeah, yeah. Oh boy, we're gonna.
Some say Akira never died.
I want to go to his universe.
We're talk
Can we go
about
to his universe?
That.
Let's go to his universe.
I don't know. Do you think it's a good universe? Yeah, they won't get squished. In
there are mutant babies there. Let's go.
So, as Steven said, Neo Tokyo is where everything after the first minute or so of this film takes place.
Yep.
It is plagued by violence, and at the height of a riot, which we see in the opening, Kaneda, and it's K-A-N-E-D-A. It's not Canada, but like, forgive all of us. Mm-hmm. And I know we are white people talking about a Japanese movie, but we're here doing our best. Kaneda is the leader of a vigilante gang called the Capsules, and they are taking on their rival gang, the Clown Game. And the Clown Gang, Steven accidentally called them the Jokers earlier, but it's interesting because, in my opinion, there is a lot of similarities between Akira and The Dark Knight Returns, and there's a lot of Akira that bleeds into some other stuff that we see throughout the 1980s, and we're going to get into that right after this. GHL, we are back talking all things Akira. I have already made the comparison between Batman and Akira. I asked Jason this when we were watching it, and Steven, I would love to know your opinion. When you look back on Akira, and specifically this opening sequence, does it scream the 1980s to you? Because it does to me.
I mean, it does, yes, especially when you take a look at what was going on with Blade Runner, you know, Brazil, all these things that are looking at cyberpunk and the cyberpunk culture.
Blade Runner, yeah.
Yeah. And you look at, and you mentioned Batman, the animated series, you can look at Batman Beyond.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah, because, you know, they base Neo Gotham on these big, giant megastructure cities. And so, yeah, the Akira influence is strong and deep, and it would be very hard to find something today that hasn't been touched by someone who watched Akira either when it originally came out or in 2006 sitting in a wood paneled basement in Canada.
There is an Akira slide in Nope. Kiki Palmer's character Emerald does an Akira slide.
That's because Jordan Peele, before he made Nope, was attached to the live action reboot or remake of Akira.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's an animator.
At this point, almost every hot director of the last 10 years has been attached to making live action Akira, to the point that I think it's never going to happen. And I don't want it to happen, to be honest with you.
Oh boy, we're going to talk about that later.
Oh, sorry. All right, park that away.
So we've only got to introducing Kaneda. So Kaneda's best friend, Tetsuo.
Oh, Kaneda. I know.
It just begs to be done.
His jacket of bright red.
Yes, Kaneda has the red jacket. Tetsuo has the red motorcycle. He's driving his red motorcycle through this riot and this chase that's happening in Neo Tokyo, and he crashes it into a weird looking little boy named Takeshi. Takeshi, I always call them mutants because, again, they remind me of the Dark Knight Return mutants.
Very X-Men, yeah.
But he's technically an Esper.
Yes.
Which is somebody with ESP powers, hence Espers, you're like a paranormal person.
Yeah, and that's a term actually that's kind of fallen out of fashion
it's
now.
It's so mid-late 20th century.
Yeah, you hear it actually, like if you go back to the original Star Trek, the original series, they say Espers a lot.
Yes. Now I think like we know telepaths and telepathy a little bit more than like the idea of ESP is I think, dare I say, dated now. The reason that there are Espers running around is because the Japanese self-defense forces have been experimenting on ESP sensitive children in a very Minority Report-esque build to keep terrorist attacks from happening again. So these children might have precognitive powers. They want to see the future and prevent bad things from happening. As a result of the crash, Tetsuo is hospitalized and immediately experimented upon by the government to see if he too has ESP capabilities. Back outside the hospital, Kaneda in his red jacket and his fellow gang members are arrested and they're locked up and they're interrogated, and he meets a girl who's also wearing red.
Yay!
Named Kai. She is an activist for the resistance who kind of fills the trope of being the only woman in the world. Unfortunately, Kaori, who's a character we're going to meet in a little bit, also exists, but Kai is the only woman with real self-awareness,
I guess. And the other interesting thing is, up to this point, even in the dubbed version, you don't really know who the... there's nothing that has been explained. Like, this is like 20, 25 minutes into
the
movie.
It's in media res.
We don't understand the mutant people. We don't understand what the resistance is. And Steven, like I said, you saw this for years only in Japanese.
Yeah.
And how was like this intro opening of all these characters and stuff in Japanese? Like what kept pulling you back in to watch this? Like,
probably the visuals purely was that, but then there was also this weird thing about who are these three creepy little children with the tattoos on their hands. And you start to make this connection about, oh, okay, well, they're being tested upon. Tetsuo is having his psychic abilities starting to manifest, and that's why the government is after him. And you know, here's Canada and Kai trying to free him. But at the same time, there's some kind of political intrigue that I really wasn't following that much of it. You know, it's a little hard to follow once you read the manga, though, in English at the time. I was like, OK, this makes a lot more sense. But yeah, it was very like, I don't know what's going on, but this is weird, especially when Tetsuo goes to the, I think it's called the nursery, and is wanting to confront the three children. I say they're children. They're very old children. They're all kind of stunted in their growth. And then the giant, you know, cars and teddy bears and all the milk stuff happens. That's like, as soon as you hit that part, you're just like, oh, just give in to all the crazy psychic stuff that's going on and just, you know, let it wash over you. Like the milk from the teddy bear's eyes.
I would. That's a sequence that takes place at Tetsuo subconscious, and it's so layered in
it's
the symbolism.
It's very creepy.
There.
It's very. Mm-hmm. It's really well done.
Akira is like a genuinely scary film.
But that's the thing I was gonna say that's the thing about I notice, especially in Japanese media, but even like very much so in like anime of this time of like the early 90s, late 80s, is that we kind of get a dollop of almost every genre in this movie. Like we get the action movie, we get the straight up like cop drama, we get horror.
There is political intrigue. Like, see, in the conversations between the army general and the scientist.
And there's like superhero stuff in here too.
Yes, yeah. I mean, down to the fact where Tetsuo is going to be wearing a cape in the end.
And then it basically ends in a giant sci-fi twist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very, as we talk about the multiverse, a very multiverse.
Yeah. And so it's like, it's weird how this like movie, like I don't like you described it earlier as like, what did you describe the genre as? Like cyberpunk?
Okay.
Sort of?
So the official description like on products and stuff is adult animated cyberpunk action film.
Yeah.
And you're so like,
the adult part, that was the thing I was not prepared for in watching this back in the day. Today we see a lot of this and a lot of other anime and a lot of other cartoons that are very adult.
Well, Invincible,
Ninja Scroll,
right?
Invincible and those kinds of things. But the minute that somebody's arm is hacked off in this thing and you see somebody's one of the rebel people are trying to get one of the Takashi kid out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And they just the police just open fire on this guy and his body is twitching. And there's blood and guts and everything flying all around. I'm just like, what have I gotten into? It was just like, at the time, it was intense. I think by today's standards, I also watched it 2 days ago, Ashley.
Hey, we watched it at the same time.
By today's standards, I was like, okay, this is on par with what I see in a lot of other things. And I have a feeling that this movie coming out when it did and getting past censors and all of these kinds of things really allowed people to say, oh, so we can not do Fritz the Cat level, you know, adult animation, but we can do animation that's on par with like the Terminator. We can do animation that's on par with
great comparison.
Aliens. Right. And so it's adult. So if you're sitting down and thinking, hey, my 10-year-old would love this movie.
No,
no.
Stephen, let me ask you a follow-up question to that. In 1989, when you first watched this, because another shocking thing about that scene, because I had the same thought where I was like, yeah, the cops obliterate this man.
They also shoot a dog.
We can see the bullets like going through his shirt and like, you know, and they wildly open fire on this man. Up to that point in 89, can you remember, because I wonder if the reason why this movie kind of grabbed people's attention and why this violence grabbed people is because for Americans, would this have been like one of the first times we would have seen something like this presented in animation?
Mm.
Like, no, I know there are other, like there's Heavy Metal and there's other stuff like that. But like this movie was also like, I mean, this movie was big, at least in Japanese. And like even in genre and nerd culture, I feel like this movie was like a tidal wave.
Yeah, so you do have Heavy Metal, you do have Fire and Ice, you do have
Fire and Ice.
Yeah, you do. You do have those kinds of things, but I don't think that they go into the graphic detail that we see in here. And of course, I'm not an Asian culture expert or anything like that. But you know, it's illegal to have guns in Japan.
Yeah.
And so I can't help but wonder if some of the excessive violence that we see in here is not only a metaphor for what, you know, is going on in Japan at the time, but mm-hmm. also a way for people to see the brutality of someone being shot with a gun.
Mm. Mm. Oh, that's very interesting.
I didn't consider that. Interesting. Yeah.
So as both of our gentlemen alluded to, we learned that Tetsuo possesses powerful latent psychic abilities similar to Akira, for whom the movie is named. And the music cue that goes anytime Akira is mentioned throughout has been aped by so many horror and science fiction movies, television, short films for years and years. Like, you will hear the soundtrack and be like, have I heard this before? No, you've just heard it aped a million times. And then we learn that Akira is the person responsible for the destruction of Tokyo, OG Tokyo, in 1988. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about why Tetsuo is called Tetsuo.
Oh, well, awesome.
So Otomo, the creator of Akira, was a big fan of a manga called Tetsujin 28 Go, aka, it translates loosely to Iron Man number 28, but is more commonly known in English as Giant Robo, which I first learned about by listening to episodes of the Major Spoilers podcast, ironically enough. And as a result, a lot of the characters are named for characters in this manga series. Like, Kaneda is named for a character in Tetsujin 28 Go, who's called Kaneda. He's the protagonist of it. So it's basically all of the characters are references to his favorite manga.
Nice.
And I kind of like that fact. I think it's cute.
I don't know if it was inspired by Akira or not, but if you've ever seen the movie Tetsuo the Iron Man, it also is cyberpunk body horror, you know, man and machine coming together kind of thing. I always feel like every time we talk about Tetsuo the character in Akira, I always think of, I wonder if that inspired Tetsuo the Iron Man.
I think there was definitely a lot of crossover between all of these properties going on at the time. Aside from Tetsuo coming into his own powers and having a lot of headaches throughout the beginning of this movie, the Esper girl, whose name is Kyoko, she kind of appears to be the most latently talented. She can speak through other people's bodies and communicate with people outside of their facility. She has a vision of Neo Tokyo's destruction, and it leads the authorities to consider killing Tetsuo because they think it's going to be at his hands because they've unleashed the beast inside of him. But unluckily for the Japanese government, Tetsuo escapes the hospital where he was being held. He steals Kaneda's less cool motorcycle and he attempts to flee on it. And he picks up his girlfriend, Kaori, on the way. They try to leave Tokyo only to drive right into a clown gang ambush. They're eventually saved by the capsules. Those are the good, it's the good gang that he was a part of. But Tetsuo has started to physically suffer, so he's taken back to the hospital. While he is back there, Kyoko and the other Esper children try to kill Tetsuo through hallucinations. And this is the scene that Steven talked about with teddy bears and milk and it is, you watch it for the first time and you're like, this is wild. Did I break my brain? But if you consider the idea that, like, milk, mother's milk, that's really like healing. That's very like something that you would think of with babies. And it's all this imagery, like with the bear, of things that are supposed to be safe that become unsafe. He's in a hospital, which is a place that's safe that has become unsafe. Like, it's a lot
and
of
childhood items becoming unsafe
exactly,
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Like twisting
things
of,
that are supposed to give you
expectations.
Comfort. Yeah.
Exactly. But he, because he's like high key, the most powerful among them, is able to gain control of his abilities, fight back, kills a bunch of hospital staff, tears through looking for all of these children who attacked him and have sort of moved on their way.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Kaneda,
I was gonna say, there's a great bit when he's escaping from the hospital that always struck with me.
What
you know,
it?
He's using his psychic powers to kill all of these people, and his psychic powers are a sphere. And you never really think of it like that until he smashes into the wall and you see it's not just a, you know, a punch in. It's a literal sphere into the wall. And I was always just amazed by that, that it was like, oh, I never thought of a psychic power like that. It was always, it just always stuck with me.
Simple shapes are the easiest to construct.
Yeah.
You know, this might have been where some of that early 3D animating was coming from in bringing these powers to the forefront.
It's funny. I'm so glad you brought that up, Stephen, because I didn't even notice that. That's really great.
That's what you get for multiple watches.
Well, he watched it for, like, Stephen probably has, like, the visuals memorized.
And this is still some things that I forget. It's been about 5 years since I watched it. And when I watched it again the other night, it's like, oh, I forgot this part. Oh, this is good.
This is where the wall turns orange.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Kaneda and Kai have been on this sort of ongoing rescue mission, and they've been searching for Tetsuo, and they're being guided telepathically by Kyoko, the Esper girl, mm-hmm. who is speaking through the use of Kai's body. Tetsuo is able to corner all of the Espers, and they eventually explain to him who Akira is and what he had done. So Akira, very, very powerful psychic, got overwhelmed, overreacted, blew up Tokyo. And as a result, he has been kept in cryonic storage under the Olympic Stadium. Because if I'm going to keep somebody far away for a long time, that's where it's going to be.
But did I misinterpret this? I got the exception that because there's several vials in it, they chopped him up too.
They did. They have broken him up into they composite into parts chunks. And they are labeled, because if he is physically
he's like Wolverine, he'll reform.
He can, you know, he could do that again, or he could do something worse.
The crazy thing is, even though he is, you know, been dissected and put into these vials and put into this cryo chamber deep under Tokyo, his psychic influence is still directing Tetsuo to come and find him.
He's calling to him, which is why, like, yeah, Tetsuo keeps saying, like, Akira. And I think that's what that very specific sound cue that I keep alluding to mm-hmm. is supposed to represent. It's like the psychic pulses that are coming from Akira.
Well, there's a bunch of stuff in this movie. It's very interesting that there's a lot of symbolism with twos in this movie and pairs.
Oh, go into that, yes.
Because, again, there's the initial explosion. There's the explosion we encounter. There's mm-hmm. the relationship of Tetsuo and Akira. There's the relationship of Tetsuo and Kaneda.
There's a relationship of Kaneda and Kai. And
there's the relationship of the capsules and the, not Joker,
the clowns. Yeah. It's a C and a C.
There's the relationship of the army general and the scientist. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, mm-hmm. and then the ending, of course, there's the two universes.
It's a lot of duality. I wouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of duality in this mm-hmm. movie. And I really like that, because I think, I hope the intention is that, you know, there's no one right way to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no right way or wrong way. There's not black and white. It's very much like, well, you know, Akira, who starts out the movie, we find out, as the villain, because we see his destruction, mm-hmm. actually becomes the hero at the end.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Akira, because I think the mystery of Akira is really well seeded. And the reveal comes, this reveal to Tetsuo, thus to the audience, comes like an hour in. He's mm-hmm. he's a god and he's not a god. He's a mistake and he's not a mistake. So, you know, if we can all cast our minds back to when we first were like, oh, it's a little boy, question mark. How do we all feel about the Akira reveal and the planting of this mystery?
I think it is really cool, because the three Espers all know Akira. They were friends with Akira. They all went through the program with Akira. They saw his destructive power. And then there are people who are around in the movie. One in particular that was also part of the program, or at least a little bit of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And she is going out preaching that Akira is alive and is a god.
Yeah.
And it essentially makes Akira this religion that people are willing to follow and do whatever for. And so then when you find out that it's Akira, this little boy,
mm-hmm.
I think that makes it scarier.
Ooh.
I agree, because it's again, it's going back to that thing of the duality, because mm-hmm. it's such immense godlike power in a child body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What are
children known for? Self-control.
Yep. 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 You've spoken as a true father.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, indeed.
I want to talk about the race to the stadium, all of the nonsense that goes on there. I want to break it all down with everyone, but we're going to hold, and we're going to do that right after this. It's Akira time here on GHL.
It's Akira time.
I don't know if that means we're going to survive to the end of the episode.
I want to make that like that's a future like sound drop. It's Akira time.
All right, any guitar players listening, we're ready for you.
Yeah. Akira time.
Anytime. Because once we learn about Akira, there are some finer points in like the political machinations, or some mm-hmm. finer points in the plot. But basically, this movie is a speed race to the Olympics stadium mm-hmm. and then a fight between a bunch of the characters.
It's basically like everybody versus Tetsuo.
Yes, and Tetsuo kind of picks up followers along the way.
And takes on his full superhero outfit with his cape.
He puts on a Superman cape. Jason and I spent a lot of time the other day talking about the relative influences of like Western and Eastern storytelling tropes as illustrated in Akira. And the Superman cape is obviously a huge part of it. He gets a Cable slash Winter Soldier type arm. He has to fight Kaneda. And I want to bring the conflict with Kaneda up specifically because Jason, I know you were like, their relationship is weird because like they're best friends, but they're not best friends. They're best friends, but he wants to kill him, which I know Steven will appreciate this reference. Gives me very like Deku and Bakugo vibes. Oh,
you are 100. I was going to, if nobody else is going to mention it, I was definitely going to bring that up during this episode because it is exactly that relationship in My Hero Academia.
Where like they love each other, but they're also rivals and like might smash each other in new football. I hate Bakugo so much. He sucks.
I brought up the point to Ashley that I was like, if somebody were to like do the American live action version, to me, the thing.
Don't do it.
Which they should not do. But the thing that I would, if it was me doing this, I would make their relationship stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would like make them like, the best of friends to make the adaptation slightly different.
And I think, you know, I think that's what they're trying to get across in this, except that Tetsuo's always meant to feel inferior, even though Kaneda is very much, I got to find my best friend. I've got to go and rescue him. I've got to do these things, even though he's a bit of a schmuck. I still love him very much, which is probably why. And I think Scott Johnson over at Frog Pants, he's always like, why does he always keep screaming Tetsuo and Kaneda?
Yeah,
it's almost like even in the midst of them fighting, it feels like I want you to look me in the eye as I pull this trigger. I want you to know that it's coming. I don't want to come up and sneak up on you. So I think there's still that kind of that relationship that's still very strong between friends, even though it is kind of annoying screaming each other's names throughout the last act of the film.
Yes. And I also wonder if maybe they were going for this and they didn't quite pull it off. The idea that like maybe Kaneda didn't realize their relationship until something bad happened, which is what happens to a lot
of it.
Yeah.
But also the, you know, we allude to the screaming and like, is it annoying? And maybe it's only annoying to our Western sensibilities.
That's
because
fair.
I think of Dragon Ball, which again was like happening and coming up around the same time where like, if you think about the Saiyans in their various states powering up, it's a lot of like, Vegeta, Goku. Like that, maybe that's just inherent in the storytelling in a way that it's like not as much. Or like, I think of All Might, Jason loves it when All Might yells on My Hero Academia. Like Kaneda is the one who like gets a cool laser rifle and blows Tetsuo's arm off, and then Tetsuo's like, that's okay, I got a cool robot arm, like don't even worry about it. But as his pain ramps up, he loses physical control over his abilities and he mutates into what it, I think is still one of the grossest things I have ever seen on screen.
I have a theory about this.
Okay, please.
Okay, so he becomes a giant flesh ball.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He starts sort of like absorbing. If any other person touches him, he either smushes you or absorbs you. It's not quite clear because it seems like he absorbs
a bit,
some people.
A bit of both. He does it to both Kaori, his girlfriend, and Kaneda.
I think.
His boyfriend.
I think. Who's the creator of this again? I forget. I'm sorry.
Otomo.
I think this is Otomo's thesis on superheroes.
Go on.
I think he is saying that no person can control that amount of power.
Ooh. You're
right. He definitely is saying that. I always took it a little bit differently from a more, let's remove it from superheroes. You know, Japan in the 1980s is going through a huge economic boom. So much so that, you know, people, and because of tradition, people are told you need to do these things. You need to go and work for this business forever. This is how you make money. And I feel like there's a bunch of children who are like 12, 13, 14 years old, 16 maybe, who are like, where is my place in this world? Because there's a lot of rebellion going on in Japan with cyberpunk and just the punk scene and rock and roll and all these things that are going on. It feels like Tetsuo's metamorphosis is going from somebody who doesn't know what his place is in the world to kind of figuring out where he belongs in the universe. Not this one, by the way.
Yeah.
And so that whole thing is a metaphor for young people finding their place in life. Now, granted, it's very gross and very over the top, but that's how I kind of always interpreted it.
So is growing up. No.
Yep.
Gross.
Yep,
I mean,
you're absolutely right.
Gross.
Yeah. I actually find this, even though I find this scene, this whole sequence disgusting, I do find it the most emotionally resonant. I think because as Tetsuo is like exploding, he's begging Kaneda to help him because he can't control himself. And then he literally crushes Kaori, the girl he's in love with, and kills her because he cannot control himself. And I think that is the saddest moment in the whole movie. It gets me because every single time.
So at one point, when the boys go back to the academy, they're all being beat up on. But when they get out of school, they all have girlfriends that rush up to them, except for Tetsuo at the beginning. But Kaori is just kind of standing back. It's not really clear that they're truly romantically involved. And when Tetsuo ascends to the top of the Olympic Stadium, she's the only one that comes to him as someone who wants to accept him for him. And everyone else does it. So, yes, her story, even though it's very small in this, is super tragic in the way that she just goes out.
Yeah, she, even though she is in this movie, that's the reason why I'm like, Kai is kind of the only woman in the universe because she's like the only one who does anything. The Espers show up. They free Akira from cryosleep and they, you know, like Humpty Dumpty put his body back together again. And he creates a singularity. He opens a doorway to another dimension or a world between worlds, which he draws himself, Tetsuo and Kanada into. And while they're in there, we get some glimpses of his of their upbringing and the fact that they did both have latent ESP powers and they did have an Esper upbringing very similar to those of like the four, if you count Akira, creepy old kids who we see throughout the films. The singularity explodes. The Kyoko's vision comes true. Neo Tokyo is destroyed exactly as it was foretold. We learned that Kai is now developing psychic powers of her own. And in this place between world, Tetsuo introduces himself and beholds the creation of a new universe and transcends beyond human existence. And you say, I didn't think a cartoon could do this.
It's to me, I was going to say like,
it's so hard to explain because it is such big world shifting concepts.
And I never would have ever considered that the ending of this movie would be. And I took it as that it's a new big bang in a new universe. Yeah. It's not another dimension. It's like they are creating a new place.
The reason I use the word dimension is if you've never seen this, I'm trying to make it clear and streamlined, but from the time
I just wanted to make sure I didn't misunderstand the movie.
But
there's a lot of interpretation
here.
From
the time we get to the Olympic Stadium, it's kind of like dealer's choice on how you want to read the end of the film.
Fair.
Is it tragic? Is it exciting? Is it frightening?
It's also, Stephen, it's very hopeful, I think, too. In a weird way.
Okay, go into that. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, Stephen, do you want to jump on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, here's Tetsuo. You know, he has been given a what is it? The life rewind, right? Where he and Kanada and everybody else gets to kind of see their lives and their existence and see that, there really was this very good friendship between these two. And we know that Tetsuo is really having a tough time controlling his powers. And when he's given this opportunity to kind of explode, he is like, I am Tetsuo. I'm giving you all life. And he gets to use his powers that were a weapon and use it for something good, you know, in this case, to create a whole new universe. And he wanted to be a god in the main story universe. Now he does get to be a god in a sense in the end of the movie. So I think that there's this hope that, you know, everything happens. Certainly when it comes to Kanada and Kai and everyone else in Tokyo, even though there has been mass destructions and millions of people have died, there's also this hope that, well, we saw what happened the last time Tokyo was exploded and look how much it built itself back up to be greater than it was. Mm-hmm. There's still that hope that even from destruction, something great can come from that.
And we go back to the doubles again, because Tetsuo starts the movie as the weakest character and ends the movie as the most powerful character.
And he's like paired with Akira.
Yeah.
Now.
But the idea that he's more powerful than Akira.
Yeah. Interesting. I see it as very cautionary in a way that's like, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah,
because
fair.
As Steven said, like, Tetsuo gets what he wants, but at what cost?
Well, and not in a way he would have ever expected,
which is life, though.
I was about to say that. It's very much life. Yeah.
Well, but it can also be very much like following up with you, Ashley, is that, you know, they're told after the explosion and after they come out that Kay is also experiencing psychic powers. And it's like, the clock restarts and we're going to do this all over again.
Well, time is a flat donut, as I think we all know. Look, we could talk for a whole other hour about this, but we have a couple traditional things to wrap up our movie episode with. So I think we're going to do this. I'm going to ask everybody to give us a rating out of five Bregos, zero being the lowest, five being the highest for Akira. And then we usually do best performer and stuff like that. But I think I just want to ask everyone, what's your favorite scene, or if there's maybe a favorite visual moment, because it's animation and we can talk about that a little more. So Jason, are you okay going first?
Please start with our guest. We must be
Well, I wanted to give Steven a little bit of time to think about
sure.
If he wasn't prepared for the format.
Then I will go. So we're starting with rating?
Can I have your rating out of five Bregos?
I'm going, look, I am not a fan of cyberpunk. I'm just going
to flatly say, it's not to your taste.
It is not. It is not to my taste. And a lot of the first hour of this movie is very cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of great visuals. It has a lot of cool things. I will say that I had this problem when I watched it 20 years ago, and I had this problem again, is that there are some times where I get Tetsuo and Kaneda mixed up.
They do have the exact same face.
Yes. And so that was a little hard. But once Tetsuo gets his powers, mm-hmm. I think from like the nightmare sequence on, mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, really good. So that's, I think I have to give it a four. I can't
still
give
an incredibly high rating.
It's not a perfect movie to me, mm-hmm. but I completely understand how this captured people mm-hmm. and how it still captured. I mean, to be honest with you,
still talking about a live action remake.
Well, I mean,
don't do it.
I was surprised at how well this held up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was pretty blown away. But again, this is a little bit more me than it is the movie. The cyberpunky city stuff kind of knocks it down for me.
That's fair.
So it's a 4 out of 5 for me.
All right, Steven.
Listen, I don't think anyone wants half a Brego, because that would be not good.
I usually ask the front half or the back half.
I would probably say the front half. But here's the thing. Because I know, I got to see this, not when it originally came out, because I didn't get to see it in a movie theater. I've never seen it in a movie theater. But I know from seeing Akira when I did mm-hmm. and seeing everything that it has influenced after, I think I have to give this five Bregos.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I really do. I think it is such an influential film. I think the animation in this for the time was mind blowing.
I think mm-hmm. it still holds up.
And it still holds up very much today. I think that just from the very extreme story that is being brought to everyone, the sci-fi story that's being brought, the animation from that time period, as good as it is, and the fact of all the influence that it had going forward, has to be five Bregos.
Mm-hmm. I am going to agree with Steven, and I'm going to give it five Bregos, because Jason and I actually wound up watching this on different days because I wasn't feeling well. And like 15 minutes in, I was like, oh yeah, this rocks. I'm having a great time. It does look 80s, especially if you're like an anime nerd and you know what the typical style kind of for each decade.
The aesthetic,
is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think it's in a bad way. And no, if that's my number one knock against it, I'm like, yeah, I do think it's as near perfect as possible for what it was when it was created. So let's do one more round, friends, and let's say, what was your favorite scene or maybe visual sequence, Jason?
Mine is, who was Tetsuo's girl?
Kaori.
There's a scene after Kaneda blows off his arm
mm-hmm.
and he reforms it, and he sort of sits down on a throne of junk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then she comes over and watches, and like he kind of spooks her with the metal arm. But that visual of him with the cape
mm-hmm.
and a metal arm and this throne of junk, like
the throne of lies.
Well, I was going to say it's very, I almost think this is where you're talking about the influences, right?
Yeah.
Like, that reminds me so much, because in 90s Spawn comics, Todd McFarlane.
I can't believe you found a way to bring Spawn into this.
I did, baby. But I brought comics back again. I think the image creators were very influenced by this movie because there are a lot of issues of 90s Spawn comics where Spawn sits on a throne of skulls.
Uh-huh.
And it's very, I kept thinking that every time I'm watching this. But I think it's just such a, look at what power will give you the kingdom,
mm-hmm.
but not the kingdom that you mm-hmm. think you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's still really, he's the king, but the king of this like really gross and grotesque place.
Yeah.
So that's like the image that really stands out to me.
All right, Steven, favorite scene or sequence?
It's the opening sequence where the clowns and the pills are fighting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Just the motorcycles racing through Neo Tokyo. You've got the parallax with the city in the background, and you got the light trails coming off of the bikes, which they're at the time was just like so beautiful. And then it all ends, you know, to me, that sequence ends with the Akira slide.
Yeah, heck yeah. I mentioned mine earlier. It's Kaori's death. It's weird to say
you
that
like
that's my
the squish.
It's weird to say that that's my favorite.
Yeah.
But for me, it's the most emotionally resonant. And
it's the one that affects you the most.
Yeah. If you're an Evangelion fan, like one of my favorite moments in Evangelion is when Kaoru is squished by the Ava, which I was like, oh wow, there's a lot of smushing of things in the late 80s, early 90s.
Lots of smushies in
Japanese anime. So. Sure. Can you believe we did this?
Yay!
This is a lot.
Steven, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise and your unique point of view. We were so psyched to have you come and share that story.
Oh, thank you so much. I feel honored to be asked to be back.
Before we move on from our Akira talk, can you let everybody know where they can best find you and support you all over the internet? You're in so many places.
Yeah, so probably the best place to go is majorspoilers.com. That's our center point for pop culture and comic book news, reviews, etc. It's a great place to go. Of course, Major Spoilers on Twitter, Instagram, and probably Substack, I believe. So you can go to all those places to find me and a whole lot more.
And Ashley, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find Geek History Lesson on the interwebs as well?
You can find us at geekhistorylesson.com. If you put a / recommended reading on there, we have some Akira stuff for you to check out too. You can find us at facebook.com/geekhistorylesson, on Twitter at @GHLpodcast, on Instagram at Geek History Lesson, and our brand new Tiki Talkie at Geek History Lesson.
Don't forget to check out Ashley on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at Ashley V. Robinson. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Jawin. And now it's time for
Stick Around.
Yeah, that's right. Hashtag Stick Around, the place where we make sure you stuck through all the plugs. Ashley, what are we talking about here? The last little tease, the last little dollop before they turn off our podcast.
I basically want to pit two of our duos, two of our bestie friends against each other. And I want to ask the both of you, who is cooler, Kaneda or Tetsuo?
Ooh, Steven, who do you think?
Oh, Kaneda, obviously. He's the hero.
Yeah, 100%. It's not Tetsuo.
I love Tetsuo. I'm like, the image of Tetsuo in the cape is like everything.
Ashley?
Yeah.
Ashley, Tetsuo smushed your girl.
He did smush my girl. But high key, though, I think my favorite character is Kyoko.
No, it's the jacket. She's cool. Like, it's Kaneda, it's the jacket and the bike.
And the bike.
And it's one of those things, I think.
It's also a very easy cosplay. It's a thing you can cosplay really well, really simply.
Yeah, and I think I said this to Ashley after the rewatch, where I was like, I actually thought I expected the bike to be more a piece.
Oh, yeah, Jason was like, I wanted more bicycles.
Yeah, because I was like, the bike is so cool. And I was like, oh, I guess I expected it to, like, be a bigger part of the movie.
And there's that whole set piece when he gets free, when Tetsuo is free, and he's like, where is, and he kills his old gang members. Yeah.
But that's like, kind of the dividing point, right, between the two. Yeah. That's where the break happens, where they're getting ready to go out and chase the clowns, and Tetsuo is like checking out the bike and is like, oh, this is such a cool bike. And then Kaneda shows up and he's like, get off my bike, you can't handle it.
Yeah.
And you see literally that's the fracture of the covetousness of Tetsuo wanting that bike, and that is really what drives the spike in between those two.
Yeah, and it's also
good word, covetousness.
And it's also the foreshadowing of, you can't handle this, Tetsuo. But look, if they make the live action American version,
don't do it.
Which, by the way, I was looking this up. They apparently Warner Brothers spent $7 million for the rights. And it was a bidding war because all the studios
which is
wanted
the
it.
Exact original budget.
if they do that, you know they'll make a sequel where it's just about the bike racing. Like it's like Akira and the Gang, like will be the second one. Or
Akira
something.
And the Gang.
Akira and the Ford Windstar. Okay. All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening to our very Akira-tastic episode. Steven, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ashley, why don't you close out, Professor Ashley, this wonderful and also frightening at the same time Geek History Lesson on Akira.
I want you all to thank me for not just, I was going to do this like at the top of my lungs in honor of Tetsuo and Kaneda, but that feels rude to do to our audio listeners.
Why don't you do it right now? Just do it in the podcast with it.
I know. I'm just going to say a very respectful, class is now dismissed.
Oh, okay.